When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Good Food Podcast. In this episode, Fred Sirex joins me, Tom Kerridge, to talk about his hospitality journey and culinary experiences around the world. Plus, he tells us all about the food in the jungle.
In the jungle, you know, the basket that you get to feed all the campmates was just incredible. The quality, the freshness, the produce that we got in the jungle were second to none. They were just incredible. In fact, I remember eating a banana. It was so good. This is the best banana I have ever had.
Fred also gives us his culinary confessions. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your hats. We are ready for a full, high energy, good food podcast conversation with the amazing, the one and only Fred Sirex. Hello, Fred. How are you?
I'm very good, Tom. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. You've come full of your normal bouncing French Fred energy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I woke up this morning, you know, and the sun is shining, and the great thing is the garden's looking good. Some of the plants I thought were dead are actually coming back to life.
That's the joyous spring.
Oh, I am so excited about spring. I can't wait. I love the garden. You know, I've got this routine in the morning. I get up in the morning, I make my coffee, put my slippers on, and then I go around the garden and I look at the plants. You know, I know every plant, you know, the one that I planted yesterday, the week before, a month before, 2 years ago. And I just love to see them and to look at them like that, talk to them as well.
Even. So is being outdoors in the garden quite a big thing for you then?
I love it. Yeah, I love being outdoors. I love being in the garden. And I just like to look at the plants grow. And, you know, I mean, I don't do any vegetables or anything like that. It's just do the plants. I just like it. It's the feast for my eyes.
I mean, we've both been in hospitality a very long time. And we all know that seasonality makes a big difference, not just to food, but to actually people's moods. And do you think that's a big thing? Do you see as it changes and the weather changes and the sunshine comes out and the plants come to life? Does that alter, do you think, the way that people react in restaurants?
I think it does, but I think it has an effect on all of us. I mean, for me, my favorite time of the year is spring, when you are coming up to the summer solstice. You know, as you're coming to the longest day of the year, I just feel so elated and excited about it. But, you know, we are in the UK. You know, I mean, it's not as seasonal as some other countries in Europe, you know, and we have to contend ourselves with a bit of grey sky and a lot of rain. And but I tell you, I've been here now for so long, you know, that I just embrace it. And I just think that whether it's the summer and it's a beautiful summer or a very cold winter, I think that we owe it to ourselves to be happy and to be enjoying life. And I think for me, I mean, we're talking about the jungle earlier on, you know, and I was telling you that it was my fittest ever, physically, mentally, psychologically. I think it's up to us to monitor our tank and to monitor the line and to always be on that line or above the line, regardless of the season. But I have to say, this January, you know, I was feeling a little down. It did affect my mood. It did affect me, you know.
Yeah.
And I could sense it. I could feel it, of course. I was thinking, Fred, you got to kick it out. You got to kick that mood out. You know, you've just got to just enjoy it and embrace, you know. But I know that the cold and the rain and just, yeah, it has that effect on people.
Do you know what? I it's weird because I love the spring and the summer so much and it's amazing. But when autumn kicks in, I quite look forward to it as a chef's point of view because I love the idea of those root vegetables and slower cooking and braising and all those kind of wintry vegetables and style of dishes that start coming onto restaurants' menus and our repertoire starts coming, you know, a little bit more homely and comforting. But I can't wait for it to end now. Let's have the asparagus, the peas. Let's get the, you know, the broad beans going. Let's get loads of greens and fresh vegetables coming alive. And I love it. I love it when it starts coming alive. There's a sense and a mood that's changing. You talked about them being in the jungle, and I'm sure we'll pick on that and regarding food and things later on. But what sort of projects have you got now going forward? What's on the books now for Fred?
Right now, we are launching The World Cook on Amazon Prime, which is a cooking show that I co-present with Emma Willis. It's fantastic. It's the second season. The reason why I'm really excited about this TV show is, as much as it is a TV show, at the very heart and at the very base of it, it's a cooking competition. And, you know, you mentioned season now, and, you know, obviously seasons is about the produce and when they come out and what grows in the summer, what grows in spring and winter, you know, and it's about really knowing the season and knowing what grows and what you can get and when. It's about the basics. And this is what I wanted to do with The World Cook. It's about setting the basics for cooking. And at the very start of it, it's about the traditional, the classic cooking and the ability of the 16 contestants who are actually, in fact, it's almost like the Olympics of cooking.
So talk me through the premise of it. These 16 contestants, are they professional cooks?
They are all professional, but for one this season. And they are going head to head and they are cooking. They are bringing one dish to the table. Like, for example, you know, if you are Thai, maybe somebody's going to cook a Thai green curry. If you are French, maybe they would cook a bœuf bourguignon. It's about the classic traditional recipe as your grandmother or as the grandmother in this country would cook it. It's about being as real as you can be and knowing and understanding the basics. You know, I don't know why I was thinking about fish and chips as I come on, because the other day I was looking at something on your Instagram and you had these beautiful fish and chips. And this made me think, you know, that everybody can do fish and chips. You can find it in the cheapest cheapie anywhere in the country. But yet there is an art to be able to do it to the level that you do it. And the reason why you can do that is because you understand the season. You understand where your fish come from and whether it's sustainable or not and when is the best time to get it. You understand what potatoes to get, how to cut them, how to cook them, what kind of oil. This is about the basics I'm talking about. And this is about the kind of knowledge that we want the chef to have. Because when they go then to another country, so the first round is in the UK, and then they are sent to a foreign country, and they find out at the very last minute where they are going. And then we introduce them to master chef of that country, who give them master classes in one recipe or another. And it's up to them to learn how to do it, and then to either recreate it or twist it. But in order to do that, you've got to have enough basic skills. You need to know about produce. You need to know about season. You know, your understanding and knowledge of cooking has to be so broad. Not everybody can do that. Yeah, and that's why it's called The World Cook.
So to interpret something, a classic dish, and make it your own, you have to understand the fundamental basics, don't you? You know, until you know how to do the simple things perfectly, you can't play games with them, can you?
No, and, you know, I mean, for example, we went to Croatia and this dish called peka in Croatia. Delicious dish. Basically, it's cooked on the embers and you cook it under a metal dome. And it's, for example, lamb or chicken, what else could it, or pork, for example. And you cook it there with some potatoes, a little bit of onion, a bit of garlic, salt and pepper. And that's that. Basically, you let the fats and time do its work for you.
So at the end of a fire, you put you put a big metal pot into the embers.
That's then, right.
With the lid on.
The lid on.
And then you put the coals on top of it as well.
Correct.
You,
right?
So you almost bury it in the hot coals.
That's
I have seen this dish, yeah. And you have to leave it for that time for everything to cool down. A little bit like pain boulanger in France. It's the residual heat of something that continues that cooking. So to get an understanding of that, it's all about understanding the residuals, the touch, the feel, the time taken. You can't rush these dishes, can you?
You can't rush these dishes. And also you have to understand the spirit of the dish and where it comes from and why it has come to be that dish. And why is it so simple after hundreds of years? Why hasn't it changed? Well, because it's perfect. And that's why it shouldn't change. And yet we had some of the contestants, for example, adding wine in it or adding other things. And for some of them, it didn't work very well. You know, because, you know, when you are going to change a recipe that's hundreds of years old like that, you've got to think, why am I adding this? Am I adding more, which is going to take away some of the power and some of the pleasure of the dish? Or are you going to do something that's going to add something? But can you imagine in all those years that people have been cooking that dish, if there was a better way to do it, it would have been done already.
Yeah. Everyone has tried whatever you're trying. Exactly that. And then I suppose we talked there about the history of dishes and the way that they've evolved and adapted and grown. But your training, you started... in mission star restaurants, your training front of house has always been one of that tradition. And talk us how that process started, where you came from, and how we found ourselves knowing and loving the Fred Cyrix that we see in front of us.
Well, I really started, I wanted to be a chef, and at catering college I started to train as a chef, and I just thought to myself, this is not for me. You know, as much as I know that you love it. You know, for me, being in a room with four walls where sometimes you don't have a window, it's hot, there's lots of grease. I just didn't see this for me as a career path that I wanted to take. And
this is in France. This is a catering college in France.
Catering college in France. I did 4 years. And I went to my teachers and I say, listen, I've changed my mind. I don't think it is for me. I want to just to be front of house. And they couldn't believe it because I was a very good chef as a student, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I didn't see myself really kind of pursuing a career, and I did not get excited about it, you know. So I changed, and I think it was such a good decision because I really enjoyed the freedom of the front of house. And it's about the art of hospitality, but it's something, you know, about hospitality that my parents were doing since I was a little boy. I mean, my parents can cook. They can cook the whole French repertoire, you know. It's like they pick up, they don't even need the Escoffier book.
No.
You want something, you just ask them and they cook
it. They could have written it for him.
Almost. So they used to cook at home all the time. We used to have a three-course meal every single day, and it was all French-based. I mean, I didn't have Indian or Chinese food before I was 18, because where I come from in Limoges, it's all about France, it's all about French food, it's all about French wine, and that's all you have. So for me to come in the UK, you know, was just like, I mean, in 1992, I was 20, I just finished catering college, and all I wanted to do was come to the UK, come to London and work in London, because it was so exciting for me to be in London, to be in a foreign country. I loved speaking English, I loved, and I still do, living my life in English. I think it's just so, so exciting. And, you know, I arrived, and because you're French at the time in 1992, you were seen as exotic.
Yeah. And where did you go? What restaurant did you turn up and start your, I suppose, English culinary training at front of house?
Well, I started at La Tanclair with Pierre Kaufman on Royal Hospital Road, where Gordon Ramsay...
Where Gordon is now.
Has got his restaurant now. And, you know, the great thing is, because I had the job, obviously, before I went there, and I arrived on the day, they introduced me, I got introduced to everybody, and then one of the waiters who had been there for a while took me to get my NHS number, took me to the bed seat where I was staying in Pimlico. I always remember it. I was paying £50 a month for my bed seat.
£50 a month?
£50 a month, yes.
I bet that was a nice place.
That was the rate at the time, you know, that was the way it was. But the great thing is, you see, you arrive there and you're taken care of, you know, and you are helped, you know, to get settled, which was very important because you don't know where you are.
But the reality of life.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to buy into it, don't you? So then how long were you with Pierre for at the Tonclair?
Well, I was there for a year. I mean, I'm like you, Tom, you know, in the sense that for me, you had to do your time in a place, you know. So if you were à La Tanclair, you had to do your time, and the minimum time was a year. Anything less than a year, it wouldn't do. It wouldn't look good on the CV.
No.
Then I went to Gavroche for 2 years and a half. Then I did my military service, which I had to do.
So you had to go back to France.
Yeah, I had to go back to France and do my military service. And then I came back and I pursued my career. You really have to do your time in order to master the skills, in order to acquire the knowledge, and to just know and understand everything that there is to learn and understand in that place. And then you either get promoted or you go to somewhere else to further your training. And the other thing also, it's interesting, but it's about your state of mind. And I remember when I was at catering college, you know, we were all sent to different placements to do, you know, 2 months here, 3 months there. And some of the places we went to, I mean, it was Alain Ducasse, for example, in Monte Carlo, three Michelin star. At the time, that was that was the place to be, right? I was at the Monte Carlo Sporting Club. I was at the Flying Squad, which is the Brigade Volante. And basically, you were setting up the restaurant in the morning at the for example, at the Sporting Club. Then in the afternoon, you were serving lunch at the Monte Carlo Beach. And then for dinner, you were again at the Monte Carlo Sporting Club, looking after people for a banquet of 1,200. But it was hard, you know, and you know what it's like, you know, in the 90s and the early 2000 working in hospital. It was tough. But I remember the way we were at school, the way the teachers were molding us, really, because what they wanted us to be in the Premier League of restaurants, the Premier League of hotels. And it was about being the best players in that league. That's what we wanted to be. But in the same time, it was so hard. And sometimes kids were coming back from placement. They couldn't take it. It was too hard. It was not physically, it was hard, psychologically, mentally. And I remember thinking, come on, you've got to be able to take it. You've got to be able to take it. Because if you can take it, then you go through to the next level.
Where does that come from? That drive, that passion for understanding that's where you've got to be. Is it, were your parents that driven?
I mean, it is my parents, for sure. My parents are incredibly hardworking. You know, they were nurses in a local hospital. And if we were at the kitchen table, you know, eating our three-course meal, as we were doing every day, they were all, because they were working in the same service, but a different wing. And my dad was working night and my mom was working late. So they knew the same people. They knew the patients who got transferred from one wing to another. But for them, it was all about the patient. And, you know, we talk about hospitality. In hospitality, we talk about the guest. It's all about the guest first, you know. And if the guest is happy, everything has to be done for the guest. Now, look, people can talk about different philosophies. No, it's got to be done from the matter of the staff or this or that. But at the end of the day, the guest pays the wages. If the guest is happy, then he will come back and he will tell all his friends and family about. So it was all about the patient for my parents. But in order to deliver the service and the care and the experience to the patient, you need to have the right work ethic. You need to be there. You need to be working as a team. You need to be a good team player. You need to know your job. You need to be good at what you do. You need to have a way with people, because it's not just about the care. You know, it's about how you come across and how you connect with people. And I remember my dad telling me a story. I was 5 or 6 or something like that. And every day he used to shave before he was going to work. He had this moustache like a French cop, very good looking, you know, and all the nurses fancied him.
Is that where you get your looks from, is it, Fred?
I can tell you other stories. Yeah. The nurses fancied my dad. My mom was so mad. Anyway, that's another story. So I said to my dad, I said, why do you shave before you go to work, Dad? And he says, you know, Fred, I need to shave because I want to look the part and I want people to feel confident when I enter a patient room, and I don't want them to feel like, who's this dirty man who's going to come and look after me? And that's why in hospitality it's important, the way you look and how you come across. Are you going to be for example, meeting and greeting people? I mean, I know I'm transgressing here, but you know, the way for me, my philosophy of meet and greet in a restaurant is you got to see, smile, say hello to people before they see, smile, say hello to you. That's the only way for them to know they've arrived.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, that's what he says. He said, I've got to look the part. And then he tells me another story. So he went into this room. This patient was there, an old man. He was covered. His face was covered with a sheet up to his nose like that. And you could only see his eyes. He was scared to death. I mean, he was in the intensive care unit of the cardiology unit of the local hospital. So things were not looking too good for him. And because of where I come from, you know, I come from a town called Limoges. And Limoges is in the middle of France, basically not much happens there, right? And in the 70s, if you were in hospital, and the chances are that you've never been to the town, never been to the hospital maybe, so it was a very big departure from your life. And also the people there, they don't speak French. They used to speak Patois, which is basically the local dialect. So like my mom and my dad, for example, come from 30 kilometers apart, and my mom speaks a dialect that my dad doesn't speak. So I understand a little bit of it, but I can't speak it because nobody speaks it anymore.
Yeah.
But my dad goes in this room and this man was scared. And he looked at him and straight away he goes, Kovai grandpa. Kovai grandpa in the local dialect means, how are you, grandfather? And you know, when I was telling you about hospitality, about the connection that you make, about engaging and connecting with people straight away on a human level, that's what he did straight away. And then as soon as he did that, the sheet went down. The guy started to smile. You start to smile from the eyes. And the connection was made. And that's what it's about. So in terms of, you see, for me, the training of hospitality for me started very, very young without even realizing I was being trained, because it's subconsciously when my parents were talking about work and they were telling me about things like that.
It's a human connection.
It entered my mind, and then it becomes second nature. It becomes part of you. This is what you do. This is how you are. It's not like something that you need to learn at catering college. Yes, you go and need to learn how to, for example, set up a table or
the fundamental basics. But actually, the real part of front of house, that real part of hospitality, is human interaction, human connection. And that comes from that first point of saying hello. I mean, that's obviously done you very, very well in terms of a professional career. But that's now flowed through into a world of media and television. And, you know, we see you on first dates where you're super calm and composed and everything is kind of like under control. But what about front of house disasters or places where has your coolness and your ability to be with people ever been tested to its fullest?
You know what? I've never had any problem with any guest. I mean, I do remember running a club about 20 years ago, which was the hardest ever club or place I've ever run. I mean, the clientele was so difficult, so difficult, that after that, anything I do is just very, very easy.
Even working with Gino and Gordon.
Even working with Gino and Gordon is easy.
Now, I mean, you've been able to travel as well. Now, we filmed Amazing Places to Eat. Now, I saw, you know, you traveled all over the place with everybody there. I mean, the episode that we did, we went to the exotics of Scotland, which was, you know, I was a little jealous that everyone got to travel the rest of the world, but actually the produce is Scotland.
It was lovely.
It's unbelievable. I had the best time and it was fantastic. But what about standout cuisine of global food that you've been able to see so much of the world through hospitality and television? Where stood out for you as being one of the best places for food and hospitality?
Well, there are so many places. But in the last series that's just out now, The World Cook, I mean, going to Croatia, trying that pekka was quite a revelation. Although it's such an easy dish that you see it done, is, yeah, of course, I've seen that before. Kind of my grandmother does a version, but she doesn't do it on the fire, covering the metal dome with all the embers and all that. It's very different. In Greece, when we were in Crete, we did this thing where you basically cook whole carcasses of, like, a goat, for example, a whole loin of pork on the barbecue, and you just basically plant your skewers where the meat is hanging on from, and you plant it in front of the fire, and then you've got to judge the direction of the wind, and you've got a direction, you've got to judge how much wood you put on the fire and how it's cooking, and whether you're going to cook that side first or the second. You know, it's just incredible. And so I think that we've discovered so many cuisine on this show, but for me, what impressed me the most was the different technique that people have to cook with fire, depending on the country where you are.
Isn't it amazing? And it doesn't matter how many people I talk to, whether it's on podcasts or just people in the street, or we just talk about food. Some of the most exciting, wonderful food experiences always seem to be about the connection between Mother Nature, fire, and the simplicity of almost like peasant-like cooking. None of it is necessarily complicated. It's just always about, here's a great piece of meat, for example. We've set fire to something, let's cook it. And it's an understanding of the spicing and the seasonings and how long it takes for things to be there. But there's something, so the raw basics of cooking always seems to be the things that people get most excited about in food. Is there anywhere where you feel that you'd love to go? Where haven't you been? Where would you like to go and explore? What food and culture would you like to go and see next, Fred?
India is a big one for me. India is such a vast, vast, vast country, whether you're in the north, south, east, or what I'm missing, the west. Yeah. I was missing the west. The culture, the traditions are very, very different. I've been to Taiwan a few years back, and one of the best meal, the outstanding meal I had was, I turn up on this farm, and there were these farmers there, they were growing vegetables, and they basically cooked what you picked in the field. And that was the most outstanding vegetarian meal I have ever had in my life.
There's something amazing about freshly picked vegetables straight from the ground where the sugars are still there. That's where the food really does come alive, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, we're talking about the jungle just before, but in the jungle, you know, the basket that you get to feed all the campmates was just incredible. The quality, the freshness, the produce that we got in the jungle were second to none. They were just incredible. In fact, I remember eating a banana. It was so good. This is the best banana I have ever had. And I was in Thailand early January to film the final of the World Cook, and I tried to find a banana just as good as the one I had in the jungle. I couldn't find one.
Couldn't find one.
It was unbelievable, that banana.
See, that's amazing. See, you don't see that. You're the behind-the-scenes bit. You see that food and you see that basket come down. You don't realise how good the food was. And you
Tom, you should do the jungle just for the basket of food.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Just to take the produce back.
I promise you, it was incredible.
Well, when you were in the jungle, you took that role on of being kind of like camp cook. You were the person that kind of knew how to cook things there. You were probably the one with the most experience. Where did you think that kind of love of food and understanding of food and cooking came from? Is that from your parents?
I mean, my parents were cooking every day, every single day. And my dad used to say, we don't have much money, Fred, but we eat well. And they would buy noble products like fillet steak, for example, or Dove sole. Or they would buy just a cheap cut of lamb and some carrots and make a nice stew with it. But it was very varied, very diverse. If we had fish one day, next day we would have meat. Another day we would have, I mean, it wasn't called vegetarian in those days, but my mom would make a tomato tart, which was the closest that we would ever get to having a vegetarian meal, for example. Then you would have a salad, you would have some cheese. Then she would make three or four desserts. I mean, the other day, it was just my mom and my dad. I call her. I mean, only last week. I worry about, oh, yeah, I made this for lunch. And then she made four desserts. She made a mousse au chocolat. She made an apricot clafoutis. Then she made a cake, you know, a marbré, you know, with some white chocolate and dark chocolate. And then what else did she make? And she made some flan.
Unbelievable. So she's still in the kitchen every day cooking.
77.
And enjoying every minute of it.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was a kid, I would get up and my mom was cooking. If I was going to my grandmother, it was the same thing. I mean, my parents were, you should have seen the part. My dad would think nothing of inviting 50 people in the house, dig a hole in the garden and cook a lamb on the spit.
And what's your favourite food then, Fred? What's your favourite dish? Is it something from childhood? Is it something that's modern or new? Is it something from world cuisine where you've been able to travel? What is it? Describe your favourite dish and talk me through it like I've never heard it before.
Well, it's very easy. It's the rabbit with the mustard sauce that my mum makes. It's a very simple recipe.
It's a classic French dish there.
But you know, the beauty about that dish is how simple it is. So first of all, you get a good rabbit. The rabbit in the UK and France are very different. The one in the UK are a bit tougher. But I think because in France, we breed rabbits. So they are in a cage. And when they're ready to eat, you kill them and then you eat them. So that's why they are a bit, they are more tender than the English one, who are wild rabbits.
Yeah, English wild rabbits, yeah.
So, very simple. You get some nice Dijon mustard all over the rabbit. You cut it in pieces. Also, the way we cut the rabbit in France is different from the way we cut it in the UK.
Okay.
Which is interesting as well. So, anyway, all the mustard everywhere. You make sure you got the mustards everywhere. The mustard, a bit of salt, a bit of pepper. And then you get one shallot, you fry the shallot with a bit of butter, and then you add your rabbit to the shallots once they have sweated a little bit, not too much color on the shallots. And then you cook your rabbit for 5-10 minutes, make sure it doesn't brown too much. And then once it's finished, you just add water. No stock, no wine, just water. And then she cooks the rabbit for 45 minutes, an hour and 15, depending on how big the rabbit is and how big, depending on the portions. And then once it's finished or almost finished, crème fraîche.
Ah,
the
okay.
Fresh cream. And then you just let the crème fraîche like that to reduce a little bit. And voila, it's ready to serve.
What's the non-negotiable on that then? Is it the type of mustard or is it the crème fraîche or is it a mixture of everything?
It's the simplicity, I think. Can you imagine? You've got rabbit, mustard, shallots, a bit of butter, water. That's all you have. But then it is served with my dad's French fries.
Oh, okay.
My dad makes the best French fries in the world. It doesn't matter the season, the potatoes, it doesn't matter anything. They are always, always perfection.
Always amazing.
Yeah.
That sounds...
So he cuts them very thinly.
Yeah.
Very thin. And fry them for 160, about 15 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
And then bring it up and turn the fryer to 190. Once it's at 190, you just finish them off at 190. So they get a little bit of color, but they're still nice and frothy inside. And they're kind of softy, you know, not like hard chips. Oh, my God. With a lapin, with a mustard sauce, it's unbelievable.
That sounds fantastic. Now, it's one of the tricks to that is not cooking it too hard and fast, because the rabbit can go quite tough because it's a very lean meat, isn't it? So you want to cook it a little bit lower and slower?
Yeah, very low, very slow. And, you know, I've had it many times in a restaurant, rabbit with the mustard sauce, and I've never found one that's better than my mum.
That's the same as in the UK where we say no one's roast dinner is as good as our mum's. That's it. Sunday lunch, you go, yeah, my mum makes
it. It's true what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What's your biggest cooking disaster?
Well, I mean, a long
time. Was it anything in the jungle?
No.
Was it everything in the jungle was magic, was it?
It was unbelievable.
Yeah. I tell you what, Fred, no one can ever say that you're modest.
No, you have to tell the truth.
This is it, yeah. And if you were by far the best cook in the jungle, then that's it, mate. So what was your worst cooking disaster? What's
my worst cooking disaster? Maybe. I mean, when I was 18, I catered in college. I remember one day learning how to make fresh pasta. And I did it at home. What I didn't think about was the proportion. And obviously, I had my recipes for 20 people, and I followed the recipe. And when my dad came back home and my mom, there was pasta, there was tagliatelle hanging in the whole kitchen everywhere. I mean, it wasn't so much, it was a disaster because my dad was mad because the house was a mess and there was, why did I cook so much pasta?
Flour everywhere.
It was a mess. And it was my pride that was hurt, you know? So that was a bit of a disaster.
Have you ever served anything to anybody, but you've not made it, but pretended you have?
No.
Never done that?
No. I mean, you know, Fruitcake likes to make this this dessert. We call it the Fruitcake Special.
Fruitcake, let's just for people who don't know.
It's my partner.
Fruitcake is your beautiful other half.
So Fruitcake was making this Fruitcake Special. Gino was at their house. And so the Fruitcake Special is basically some nice ripe strawberries, some raspberries, some blueberries, a little bit of meringue on the top, and custard. And
kind of like a play on eat and mess, it sounds like.
Something like that. And I said, Gino said, but didn't you make everything yourself? I said, no, it's a Fruitcake Special. Everything is from M&S.
Yeah.
But this is, the meringue is so good. The custard, you know, the vanilla, the Madagascar vanilla is so good. Well, you don't have to make everything every time.
No, that's it. Especially if you've got friends coming around. What about a guilty pleasure then?
Well, one of my guilty pleasure is biscuit. Especially the petit chocolat, which I take and I make a coffee around 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon and I dunk my biscuit in it. But I like to dunk them 2 by 2 and sometimes 3 by 3 because I am so greedy when, oh, I love them and I dunk them and it's just, oh. The thing is, there's a technique to dunking. Are you a dunker?
I'm not. I like a dry biscuit and a wet, and I'll combine the two, but only in my mouth. I won't dunk. I'm too scared of them breaking. I'm too scared of ruining my coffee.
That's what I was saying. There's a technique to it and you've got to have a spoon at hand. So when you dunk your biscuit, you've got to have the spoon ready just in case.
Oh, you see, you live life on the edge, Fred. I'm too scared, mate. I'm too scared. Okay, some quick fire questions. What's your favorite task to do front of house?
I think it's meet and greet. Meet and greet the guest. I think that the first port of contact, you know, the first time you meet them, the first time they meet you, it really is a great opportunity to establish that relationship. And for me, I see it as something as fundamental as establishing a relationship of trust. Because without trust, you don't have anything in life. You know, trust is the basis of love. Trust is the basis of loyalty for restaurants. And this is what it's about. So they can trust you, but they trust you to deliver something that they want and to deliver it as good as if it was delivered for yourself. That's what it's about.
Amazing. What did you have for dinner last night?
Well, I made myself some, because I was alone at home, so I made myself some simple pasta with some mushroom, a touch of butter and parmesan.
Simple. Sounds delicious, though. Favourite sandwich filling?
Hmm. There's quite a few, actually. I'm a bit biased for ham and cheese toasty.
Ham and cheese toasty?
Yeah.
Yeah, can't go wrong with that. Best kitchen tip you've ever been given?
Clean as you go.
Clean as you go. That is, I mean, that's so chefy, but it's very, very
well, true. It's very important. When I was 14, I did this placement with a friend of mine who was, I mean, much older than me. He was maybe 25 or something. Anyway, he was a pastry chef. And he said to me, Fred, there's two ways to do the job. You either sit down and wait for the time to come and then you clean, or you work through and when it's time to go, you go.
Yeah.
And here, we clean as we go.
And then you can go home early.
That's it.
There you go. It's all about getting home early. What do you listen to when you're cooking?
Reggae.
Is that forced? Is that you made to listen to that or you want to?
No, I love reggae. Okay. I love reggae.
Most overrated food?
Most overrated food? I think it's the food by pretentious people who don't know what they're doing, really, who think that they don't understand the basics. They don't understand taste. And I've been in restaurant before with people say, oh, what do you think of that? You know, it's on the menu now. Like, oh, my God, I remember when, I'm not going to tell you where or when, the chef put this thing on and said, it's got to come off, mate. It was like this escabeche. It was so vinegary. It was just so acidic. It was awful. But I just think, come on, man, you're just, did you try that food? Did you try that dish? Did you
pretentious
try the combination?
Restaurants, they are something that really is painful, isn't it? What about underrated food?
Underrated food. I mean, you can go to a local cafe and have a jacket potato with tuna mayonnaise and a bit of cheese served with a smile. And you're like, this is it. This is the
jacket
best.
Jacket potato, massively underrated. Jacket potato. I love a jacket potato.
It's the best.
It's magic.
That's the best.
That's a great shout there. Worst thing you've ever eaten?
Worst thing I've ever eaten. In North Korea, I had this drunken crab, which is basically a crab that is drowned in soy sauce. And this is how it's cooked. But it tastes quite soft. And then you just eat it, you just remove the shell and you eat it. And the consistency, the texture of the crab is... I mean, I know I eat funny stuff. I mean, I know for the Brits, the French eat funny stuff, but that was a step too far.
Yeah, I got to say, from a nation that eats horse and snails
horse
and frog's
nice.
Legs. Yeah, I've eaten them all. But from a nation that makes it part and parcel of their standard cuisine, to say that crab, I mean, that's a big push.
You have to try it, though.
Yeah, I'd love to, but I've got a shellfish allergy, Fred, so I'll have to turn that one down. I'll just stick to the horse. What's the ultimate comfort food?
Ultimate comfort food, an Indian takeaway.
Oh, good shout, Fred. Yeah.
In fact,
would you have?
Atul Kochhar just got a restaurant where near I live, and I order from him very often. And you just have a takeaway on a Friday, and his butter chicken is just something else.
Really?
Oh, my God.
I mean,
so
Atul's
tender,
such
so
a great
tasty.
Cook. Yeah. And again, that sounds like the ultimate comfort food, that, doesn't it? Butter chicken from Atul as a wonderful Indian spicing. I mean, it doesn't get better, does it? Finish with sticky toffee pudding?
Pourquoi pas?
And lastly, mate, what makes you super optimistic for the future?
Well, I think we all have a choice in life. You know, I think, you know, for me, you know, I think that it's like getting old. You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to turn into vinegar, or are you going to turn into a beautiful bottle of wine, you know, who's aging gracefully? And that's my aim. My aim is to age gracefully and to enjoy, because at the end of the day, the way I see it, it's very black and white in a way, you know, either be happy or not be happy. But I think it's my choice, and it's up to me to make it. It's up to me to make it happen for me. And that's how I decided to live my life. That's how I want to wake up in the morning, and that's how I want to go back to sleep at night.
I love that, mate. Well, listen, thanks ever so much for coming in, Fred. Good luck with the second season of The World Cook, and we will catch up soon.
Thank you, Tom. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Good Food Podcast. Tune in next week when I'll be joined by Atul Kochhar to discuss spicing up spring. Don't forget, our bonus cook-along episode is out on Thursday. For more recipes and inspiration, visit goodfood.com or download our app.